You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Pacific Power is requesting to split up residential rate increases that could ultimately result in a 1.9% increase by next summer. That's if utility regulators quickly approve the proposal. The company, which serves more than 500,000 people in Oregon, says it will help alleviate financial pressure from increased energy costs and limited access to capital. The company is also paying out billions in wildfire lawsuits. Charlotte Schuff is with the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, a utility watchdog group. She says the request seems like a loan to Pacific Power and could set a precedent for other utilities to do the same.
And what we're worried about is that they're attempting to minimize what could be a very real impact for Oregonians.
Pacific Power says if the proposal is approved, residential customers could expect to pay $3 more a month on their bill next summer. Jackson County now has the state's first floating solar project. Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports on the benefits of placing solar panels on bodies of water.
Crews have installed more than 1,700 solar panels on a Medford irrigation reservoir. The power generated will bring much-needed revenue to the Medford Irrigation District. That district is looking for ways to fund modernization projects like replacing canals with pipelines. Julie O'Shea with nonprofit Farmers Conservation Alliance says covering part of the reservoir with panels can also save water.
A significant amount. We could be losing 2 evaporation overall in the summer. So if there's a way that we could cover that with floating solar and have the other benefits of revenue generation and reduce bills, it's a real win-win-win across the board.
The results of the initiative will provide important data for other groups. O'Shea says irrigation districts around the West are considering similar projects. I'm Justin Higginbottom in Ashland.
You're listening to KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Astoria Fire Chief Dan Crutchfield has announced he will retire at the end of this year. Crutchfield was hired in 2019 to serve as Astoria's fire chief. He replaced former chief Ted Ames. Crutchfield's retirement caps a 33-year career in the fire service. He began as a volunteer firefighter in Coos Bay, then transitioned to a professional firefighter. During his tenure in Astoria, Crutchfield formalized the fire marshal and emergency management position, established a fire safety inspection program for Astoria businesses, stood up community relief areas in preparation for localized emergencies, and modernized training standards for the fire department. The city is beginning the process to recruit a new fire chief. That chief will lead a department of 12 professional firefighters and 10 volunteer firefighters, as well as administrative support staff.
Ocean cruise ships will bring 28,000 passengers this summer to Astoria, a town of 10,000 people. Each passenger spends about $100 a day, meaning cruise ship visits are quite a boon for Astoria. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Christian Fodenvenzel was recently at the port when the Norwegian Jade was passing through and docked for the day.
Teresa Jones and her daughter Skylar run Northwest Nut out of Ridgefield, Washington. To get the first booth at the bottom of the docking ramp, they wake up at 3:30 a.m. and drive 100 miles.
We are here when they step off the ship. They can smell the nuts. They see our signs. We roast on site, and then we sample everybody as they get off the ship. So they have all day to think about it, and as they come back, they will line up here. We will have nothing left.
Each bag of nuts is $20, not $22, because that would require change, and passengers are usually in a hurry to get back on their ship. Teresa is pleased Norwegian Cruise Line caters to an older crowd.
Some people say if you look at their shoes, you can tell if they're going to buy or not. Today, if you look at their shoes, there's lots of tennies, so they'll probably buy.
Meaning?
If they're fancy shoes, they cruise all the time and they don't buy.
So, if passengers cruise a lot, they don't buy a whole load of snacks and tchotchkes to bring home. Teresa estimates she and her daughter will sell about $2,000 worth of nuts over the 12-hour day.
Welcome, welcome. You're in the northwest corner of the state of Oregon.
By 8:30 in the morning, cruisers are walking down the ramp to be greeted by Teresa and the Clatsop Cruise hosts. Passenger Patricia Lauck is a Walmart employee from Baltimore, Maryland. She chose this cruise so she could compare the East and West Coasts. She spends about $150 a day when the ship docks.
You get a sweatshirt, they're about $30 or $45, so that's almost $100. And then I get magnets, and then I get keychains for my coworkers, and then I get picture frames, and then I might get me a sweatshirt or a couple t-shirts for the grandson.
The Clatsop Cruise hosts welcomes her down the ramp. The host will be at the bus stops around town, outside stores, and at the museums, all with a view to making visits as enjoyable as possible. Marianne Soderbergh helped start the nonprofit hosting group in 1981.
It really is an economic boom, but that wasn't our goal.
The goal, she says, was to build one-on-one relationships with cruisers to showcase the town and encourage them to return, not necessarily on a cruise, maybe for a vacation. It's all about bolstering the town, she says.
What happens in the cruise business is once a cruise line identifies a location or destination that people enjoy, then all the other cruise lines want to come there.
Before COVID, 30 ships a year would visit Astoria, and there were some 200 volunteer welcomers. But the pandemic put a stop to that. Over the last few years, cruising has returned, but there'll only be 12 ships this year. And Robbie Mattson, the secretary of the Cruise Host Association, says their volunteer ranks have shrunk to about 60.
I think a lot of it is many have aged out. I think COVID, people got used to not volunteering or took up other things to volunteer for.
She'd love to hear from anyone who'd like to help. Meanwhile, just about everyone in Astoria welcomes the ships. Caroline Levin with the Columbia River Maritime Museum says attendance triples on cruise ship days, going from maybe 200 to 700 visitors.
As you could see when you came in the lobby today, it was busy out there. Typically, midweek this time of the year can be a little bit quiet.
But Levin says it's the river cruisers along the Columbia rather than the ocean cruisers that really boost their bottom line.
American Cruise Lines runs 7 different boats on their Lewis and Clark trip, which goes from here to Lewiston, Idaho. And they're here almost 200 days a year.
Catching cruise ship passengers, whether on the big ships or the riverboats, is no guarantee. Jen Bergman with Sunyi Sushi says they've tried everything from coupons to free keychains.
They just walk by our restaurant, and we think it's because they fed pretty well on the ship.
Of course, not everyone is thrilled about cruisers. Chris Lamb owns the Lonely Crab Record Shop and seems conflicted.
Mainly it's packs of entitled, disinterested tourists coming around, taking up space and fingering the merchandise, to be perfectly honest. And on the flip side of that, I mean, I'm glad it happens. It's good for the town. This town used to be a city of industry, and now it's a city of service.
Astoria cruise season began April 9th with the arrival of the New Amsterdam. By October, 28,000 passengers will have visited. Christian Fodenvenzel, Astoria.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Turning now to news from Washington State. Students at the University of Washington are feeling on edge. The suspect in the murder of a UW student is still at large. The 19-year-old transgender woman was killed at an off-campus apartment complex. And as KUOW's Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports, there are many unanswered questions.
On campus, first-year nursing student Tahitna Bihoneng was at the food trucks. She says her friend group is scared to walk around at night now.
We usually do have plans to like go out and get dinner like Thursday nights or whatever the case is, but now I think we've all collectively decided that we're just not going to leave our dorm at night anymore until this whole situation's been resolved.
Like many students, she wants more information to know how the police are responding and how the university is working to keep students safe. Another big question is if the murder was a hate crime. Seattle police say the motive is under investigation. In Seattle, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
Hundreds of Western Washington residents may be eligible for special unemployment payments if they lost work due to December's extreme storms and floods. The Washington Employment Security Department has just created a process to apply for the money. State ESD Commissioner Cami Feek says anyone who believes they qualify needs to meet specific requirements.
They have to have had at least 1 week of unemployment after the date of that disaster, and then they will complete an application, and then they just provide proof of employment and income.
The money to pay for this comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Department of Labor. It was made available after the president approved Washington's request for disaster relief. Governor Bob Ferguson says about 75% of his requested $182 million will come to Washington. To find out if you are eligible for disaster unemployment relief, call 855-952-9988 weekdays during business hours. There's a new kind of fish passage on the Clay Ellum River Dam near Roslyn, just east of the Cascades. It cost $288 million to construct, paid for with state and federal dollars. It's called a fish helix. KNKX environmental reporter Bellamy Palethorpe went to check it out.
Looking at diagrams of this new structure, you might be reminded of the circular driveways at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. It's a similar shape, but not as large. And on this day, it's nearly submerged by the dam's reservoir. A small group of advocates for fish and for farmers are gathered inside the spiral structure. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation was leading the tour in collaboration with the Yakima tribe. Chad Stewart is the field office manager here for the federal agency.
Probably looks faster than it is, but you look down.
Looking down, he says this design makes the ride past the dam much gentler for baby fish on their way to the mouth of the Columbia River system. These are sockeye. Previously, they had a more treacherous journey over the dam down a spillway. The helix is more like a water slide at an amusement park, with a tunnel at the bottom that they glide through. It's designed to nurture the instincts of the baby fish to swim upstream and help make them stronger on the way down as they ride backwards. Joe Blodgett is in charge of this project for the Yakima tribe. He says that this is important progress in reaching the goal of self-sustaining fish runs.
But we will see all of the stocks that were once here back returning to, at numbers that we can at least have that hope that the next generation or generation after that will continue on.
Normally, melting snowpack would allow these fish to move only when the reservoir is full. They would spill over the top of the dam. Now, this new structure is taking over for the mechanism that nature previously provided. With the helix, the fish can meet the water at lower levels. There's no need to wait for full reservoirs to get them past the dam. That means Washington's water shortages will be less lethal to these fish as the ongoing drought challenges the region. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
For years, the Yakima Nation has fought to protect a sacred area in south-central Washington from development. They say a proposed energy storage project will destroy this area, known as Mother of All Roots. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt went to a ceremony there.
High above the Columbia River, a group of young girls from the Yakima Nation perform a welcome dance. They flow together around in a line, occasionally extending a foot to the side and reaching their hands toward the ground. This area near Goldendale is called Pushpum, or Mother of All Roots. Elaine Harvey is a member of the Rock Creek Band of the Yakima Nation. She's fought to protect Pushpum for years.
On a good day, on a clear day, you can see all the way down to Sisters Mountains. And on a good day, you can see Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens over here. This is a really high point.
Pushpum is home to a seed bank for traditional medicines and roots. It's also a spiritually important spot for the tribe. Bronsko Jim Jr., or BJ, is the chief of the Rock Creek Band.
Nobody planted these foods. Nobody brought it here. It was intended for us to be here.
Yakima Nation members are gathering here, along with other tribes and environmental activists, to stand against an energy storage site that could soon be built nearby. It's called the Goldendale Energy Storage Project. Developers say it's needed more than ever, as the Northwest uses more carbon-free power. Eric Steimley is with Rye Development, which is getting the project off the ground. He says they're working to mitigate damage from the potential project. In earlier interviews, Steimley said he believes this is one of the best places to build this type of project in North America.
This particular site has been studied for pumped storage for more than 30 years.
The tribe has pushed back against two similar proposals at this same spot in the past. Harvey says, just don't build it here.
I believe we can go green, but in a responsible manner and not destroying shrub step.
Recently, the project got a key federal license. That means construction could start very soon. Simone Anter is a senior attorney for Columbia Riverkeeper. The environmental nonprofit is helping fight the Goldendale Energy Storage Project.
It's not built yet. There's no shovels in the ground, and so there's a real possibility that there won't be.
Anter says Columbia Riverkeeper plans to ask a federal court to review this license. The Yakima Nation says they've lost land to things like dams and wind turbines, and they say they're now tracking more than 80 proposed projects on ceded lands. That includes renewable energy projects, new transmission lines, and more data centers.
And I feel like it's coming too fast, you know, and our people were pushed aside.
Come on out, everyone. Let's do it intertribal. We're gonna go to the right.
To show support, members from tribes across Washington and Oregon came to Pushpum, often joining together in intertribal dances. The Klamath tribes in South Central Oregon are fighting a similar project. It's called Swan Lake Energy Storage. They say it destroys sacred rock stack features and culturally important foods. William Ray Jr. is the Klamath tribe's chair.
The struggle between our nations and Indian country, it crosses every border of Indian country since the coming of the non-Indian, and it's been a battle for literally our survival.
Tribes say they'd like to be at the table when energy projects are first proposed. They say that could avoid these sorts of high-stake conflicts. I'm Courtney Flatt at Pushpum, outside Goldendale, Washington.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN news team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. It took two trips to the U.S. Supreme Court to finally draw a second majority black congressional district in 2025 after a defiant Alabama legislature would not. May 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court majority reversed course, granting the state of Alabama's emergency request to draw new maps after the Calais decision. Alabama's population is almost 27% African American, but in 2022, in only one of seven congressional districts, did black voters have a realistic chance to elect the candidate of their choice. In 2023's Allen v. Milligan case, Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh sided with the liberal justices and agreed that the Alabama legislature had intentionally diluted black voting power and that new maps were required under the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. The Alabama legislature responded with another map violating the VRA, later struck down by an appeals court. The court instead ordered a special master to create a map with two majority-minority districts. It was that map which was stayed by the High Court's same conservatives May 11th, reversing their own precedent and clearing the way for the Alabama legislature to likely eliminate both black-majority congressional districts and add additional GOP congressional seats. We have more on Allen v. Milligan and the Alabama legislature's discriminatory redistricting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN.